Welcome to Cats Cast, a bi-weekly podcast delivering interviews, arts, culture, and history from New York's Catskill Mountains. Nick Lyons is a writer, editor, and publisher of books that celebrate his lifelong passion, fly fishing. "I really was too passionate about it," he told the New York Times in a 1997 profile. "I almost lost my wife and my children," he said, but added, "I have it under control now." Among his books, Spring Creek, The Seasonable Angler, and Fisherman's Year. Not long ago, but long enough that we could sit in a small room together, unmasked, to listen to stories, we had the pleasure of recording a conversation with Nick Lyons at the Jerry Bartlett Angling Collection at the Phoenicia Library. Following is his story.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Thank you all for coming, for being patient. This started in September when I was supposed to come, and I had pneumonia, then it happened again, that I had a family matter that I had could not break. My granddaughter was playing Lear in King Lear, so I just thought that was a unique situation that I couldn't pass up, but I'm delighted to be here. And I'd like to talk about some of the early moments of my fishing, how I got started, which is different in each case, but it overlaps with the way everyone got started, I think. And then get to the publishing, which became an important part of my life, and something about it. And I'd be glad to answer any questions eventually that would be of some help. I was a cunning little kid, and when I was six, I think, I can remember back that far, I was catching everything that moved up at the Laurel House. I caught frogs, salamanders, newts of various kinds, crayfish, and then eventually a catcher gets to the catching of fish. And I can remember catching perch and what we called shiners, got quite large, in what is called South Lake now. My grandfather owned the Laurel House in those days. Most of what went on with the older folk were pinochle on the back deck and swimming. No one else fished. Come on in, Bruce. And Star. Star is invited also. So I was just at the place where I'm catching everything that moved up at the Laurel House. And there was a comic that they hired to be there and entertain the guests, not just at performances, but also to walk around and make them laugh a little bit. He had the name of Pitsy Katz, as I remember. And I did my first enterprising activity related to fishing at that time. He paid me 5 cents a frog, little frogs, the little ones, to go under. He would turn a cup over like this, or all the cups were turned over when they served at the dining table. And then when somebody opened it up and they saw the frog, it became a moment of some hilarity and shock. There was a little creek that came out of South Lake. I think it's called simply Lake Passage now or something like that. I don't know what South Lake, what they sell now, what it produces now, but it only had shiners, bluegills, been rather big, and also perch in it. And what I didn't know, since I had never seen one of them, was that it also had the shark of the pond, a very large pickerel that ate everything in sight and were better catchers than I was. One day I was bringing in a shiner of maybe 6 or 7 inches long, and suddenly, like a dog taking it, the shot of a pickerel comes along, grabs it, doesn't get the hook in him, but I wouldn't let go. He wouldn't let go of his meal. I got him into the boat and lost an aunt who started to scream. He was out there with me. The little runoff from the lake had a little area just below where the water was very clear and where the smaller pickerel, maybe 11, 12 inches were. And being a devious little kid, I figured out that in a short time that they wouldn't feed down there. And what I had to do was get some piano wire on the end of a stick, put the piano wire down with a noose on it, and yank them, and I got them. My next big accomplishment was even worse, and I've had very, very bad childhood for someone who became a lunatic fly fisherman for a while. Partway down the runoff from the lake, there was a little ballooning of the water of the stream, and lying on the boards one day, just watching things happen, I spotted the nose of some fish I'd never seen before, quite lovely, and hiding under one of the bulwarks. And this is midsummer, I think. I tried everything I could. I used worms, of course. I started with worms. I tried a crayfish. I tried one of the frogs. I was capable of trying anything that I had caught elsewhere to catch a fish. Nothing got this thing to move. So I went down onto the buttress of the little bridge, and it was trout. It was a very big trout, maybe 15 inches, which was a lot for me. I tried the wire on him, but I couldn't get it around him. And then I figured out the only way to do this, since he was a very tame and quiet trout, was to tie a Carlisle hook on the end of one of these sticks that I used, probably an alder, tie it on the end, and very, very patiently, perhaps after 10 minutes of very slowly lowering it down, slip it below the head and yank. So I did so, and I caught this really beautiful trout. Killed it immediately. It's beautiful, probably the last of the Mohegans in that water. I brought it back and was feeling very, very proud of myself. A fly fisher happened to come up to visit at that time, a man named Leo Mertzel, as I remember. And he had a trunk full of fly fishing equipment. It seemed bizarre to me to have boxes of flies, 6 or 7 rods in cases, special places for the reels. This would have been in 1940, maybe 1939, perhaps. I didn't know what it was about. And he was brought to me in good time as the resident angler, all of age 7, and wanted to fish for trout, naturally. I told him that I'd heard of a trout. I didn't tell him the whole story. He looked like it would be too complicated. So we went to the pond first, and he fished for bass, and he got nothing. There were no bass in South Lake at that time. And we fished for a week, and I really tolerated him, you know, with his flies and all of his equipment. Then when he left, I had a little drawing that I had made of this trout before I turned it over to the kitchen to cook it. And I sent him the drawing and said, here's something is this a trout? It's something I caught a little before you came, and I caught it on a worm. So I not only caught it by gigging it, but I also lied. And it was the beginning of many lies that fishermen are heir to. And I remember him writing back and saying, you know, it looks like a trout to me, but I really couldn't be sure from your drawing. And that creek that we fished didn't have any fish in it, so I'm not sure what it is. It was my first falling. I fell, and things continued. The last time I fished was with a very old friend named Knox Berger, a literary agent, and we fished in a place called Bill's Pond, Bill Cronenberg's Pond. You may know Bill. It was filled with absolutely gigantic rainbow trout that he fed on pellets, and that's all they wanted. They want pellets for lunch, dinner, all the time, and they would come readily to it and not to the fly at all. I had taken a few of the fish. I'd figured out the great problem that you needed a pellet imitation, not a fly. And Knox, I'm afraid, was on his last months. He was very frail, lost a lot of weight. He was a great literary agent, and he wore a t-shirt all the time saying, honest prose and words and nerves of steel. And I don't think he weighed 90 pounds then, and his eyesight had gone bad, and his hearing had gone bad. And it was coming to the end of things, as things go. He wanted to fish once more, so I figured the best place was Bill's Pond. I took him there, and just as we sat down, I said, "Knox, you can't catch them on flies here. You need a special pellet fly that I've devised." The big devising, it was a piece of cork that had a hook in it. But Knox said, "No hamburger." He'd want just to fish with flies. He couldn't tie the fly on himself. He couldn't hardly see it. So I tied on flies, 4, 5, 6 flies that we changed. And nothing came to it. I mean, you could see these huge fish cruising. Finally, he put on the, he didn't put it on. But he said, "One more try." And this time, went to the side. I put on the famous lion's pellet fly. And of course, the first cast, something, I don't know, 20 inches, maybe 7, 8 pounds, comes and takes it and just about pulls Knox into the water. He's sitting on a chair and I have to hold him with two hands or he's gonna go in. We bring it in, put it in the net. He puts his hand over it so he tells how big the thing is, and it's gigantic, and he turns and says to me, "No hamburger." You know. And I said, and I lied, just like I had lied about the trout. I said, "That's right, Knox. It was a great catch, a great fly." And I lied in my teeth. In between those two events, I learned a bit about the ethics of it all and did a batch of different kinds of fishing. I think that the most interesting part of my relationship to fishing, and including all types, is that my father had died before I was born. My mother had to work. Living with my grandparents, people thought I was being spoiled rotten. I was a nice kid then. I mean, I didn't believe that they were going to do to me what happened. They sent me to a boarding school, and it scared the shit out of me. I really, really had never seen anything like that in my life. It had one virtue. It was on a pond called the Ice Pond, which had been used in revolutionary times for cutting ice. And I went there, and there were pictures of me fishing it. And I believe that it probably saved my life, going down to that pond, fishing with the bobber, watching the pecking, trying to tell what was down there, watching the lines go into the water, the lines of light going into the water, and somehow touching something numinous and real and mysterious. And it hooked me, and I became very, very involved with it. When my mother finally remarried, we lived in Brooklyn, and I fished for all the junk that was available down at Sheepshead Bay, hackleheads of one kind or another, fish that blew up when you touched them, fished with odd names, and loved it madly. Trout still echoed in my brain a little bit. And at 13, I was quite small at 13, I began to make the long trip with a friend of mine by subway from Brooklyn to Grand Central and from Grand Central up to Brewster. We had big backpacks on us, we had rods, we could have lived for a month in the wilderness with all we took up for this one day. And we caught trout. We were catchers. We knew how to catch and kill trout in those days. First with night crawlers that we got on the lawns in Brooklyn and almost got arrested for, and go around with a flashlight on someone's lawn, you're liable to get arrested. And then with spinning lures for a while, which seemed to us a very great advance on our technique, particularly something called the Homa Reverso, which sounds worse than it is, I guess. But and also a fly called a spinner called the CP Swing, which was the great killer. I remember the second time we went up, I found a feeder creek to the East Branch and was fishing with worms and a bobber, and caught a greenfish about that long. I would have been 14 that year. It was a fish of 12, 13 inches. Put it on a stringer. Didn't know what the devil it was. Caught another. I had three of them on there. And the warden came. The only time a warden has ever come to visit me while I was on a river. And he said, "How's luck?" And I said, "Well, I just got this nice green trout," I said. And he said, "Did you get any more of them?" And I said, "Yes," and showed him the stringer. And he said, "They're not trout, son. They're bass. They're smallmouth bass. The season doesn't start until July 1st. I can remember vividly taking the fish I had on the line off and let him go immediately, and then the ones on the stringer, one at a time, the last of which was over on its side, wiggled for a while, went downstream, and I kept praying that it would suddenly right itself and take off. Finally it did. He said, learn the trouts, son. learn the fish, learn what the fish are," which I tried to do. I think that the years in college at the University of Pennsylvania, I fished a bit, and I picked up a fly rod for some reason, one of those Shakespeare rods, and figured out that you don't put the line through that little ring that's just at the that you can't cast as well when you put it in the little ring. I would cast in the palestra while I was, went after basketball practice. I didn't get very good at it, and I didn't think it was a good way to catch fish. I didn't believe you could catch fish that way. But in graduate school in Michigan, I went to the Osable once for a visit, just going up country. And I stood at a bridge, one of the bridges over the Osable. And I stood there for a minute watching a fly fisherman, really the first I'd ever seen. I was 25. I'd been in the Army. I'd really advanced my fishing to being a very lethal kind of killer of trout with a spinning rod. But I watched this guy, and there was something about the fly rod and the line and the aerial ballet that took place when a good caster is working. And the fly guy, and he was using a big yellow fly, big sulfur of some kind, and you could watch it go down right under he would cast it just upstream of some overhanging branches, and you could watch the fly on the surface, a dry fly of course, float down and slip into the main current. And then of course a trout came up and took it, and it just electrified me. I almost lost my wife on that trip. She was sitting in the rain in a car and couldn't figure out why I was standing on a bridge in the rain over that. But it was absolutely hypnotizing to see that casting, the fact that he not only caught a fish, but also caught it beautifully, caught it in an interesting manner. And after that, I became more and more involved with fly fishing. Till one summer, I was beginning to fly fish a little more in the Sawkill that runs through Woodstock. Spent a couple of summers there with four children, all of whom were quite 4 years apart, and from the youngest to the oldest, and looked like quadruplets at times. And we required two or possibly three babysitters at a time to handle them. But I would slip off to the Esopus, which I, when I first had contact with Ed, who was the master of the Esopus, and I also fished the creek, the little Sawkill. Someone told me about a man who was a painter named Manny Bromberg told me about a man who was the best serious fly fisherman of them all, and I had to go with him, and he was going to set up a trip. It turned out to be Frank Maley, and in the fullness of time, maybe 2 weeks of trying to get him, I finally made an arrangement to meet at 8 o'clock in the morning at Jim Mulligan's house. I don't know whether you knew Jim Mulligan, a cartoonist for the New Yorker. So we set out at 8 o'clock, to go to the beaver kill, which he called Mecca. The trip, we finally got there at 8 o'clock that night. Frank was in his cups for a while in those days. And he also would stop and at every bar, and he would make comments on every person he saw. He'd stop and look at someone in the fields and give me a whole story about them. And it was quite an event. We finally got there. I've never been a drinker, but I think I'd had one or two beers along the way. I could hardly stand. We rushed down to the water. I had that winter tried to develop a fly that would imitate the spinner of the green drake. I called it the pigeon drake. And what you find in New York are a lot of pigeon quills hanging around. So I had taken the quill, strapped it to something, put some white hair on the sides, and I thought this was going to be a great, great fly for that hatch. I get out on the water, weaving and bobbing, I make a cast, and can I call it a fucking thing? sinks like a stone. It was terrible. By the time I got it off and got on new flies, Frank had calmly, with his pipe and mouth, caught one fish and was catching a second fish. We left. We got back in 45 minutes, I think. And I kept thinking about this odd day. And I, you know, from my teen years, I'd wanted to be a writer. And I'd written, by this time, maybe 15 scholarly essays based on the advanced studies in English that I'd done at Michigan. I'd written somewhat about the publishing world, which I was now involved with. But somewhere in the back of my head, there was something else rattling around, some other voice. And this voice didn't seem to me mine, the one I was using to write about Chrétien de Troyes or Kafka or other folks. So I sat down and I wrote this story called Mecca about this trip with Frank. It just came right out. It's not the best piece of writing, but it was a different voice, and I could feel it as being different. I sent it off to Field and Stream within 3 days of the time, and they responded within 3 days. The New Yorker has yet to respond to something. I'm still trying. Now they don't even respond. I mean, but in the old days, they used to send little slips of various kinds. I had shoe boxes full of them. But there was something about that prose that really said maybe this is closer to what would be a happy thing to write. So I sat down and wrote another about gigging this trout, which I called First Trout, First Lie. I sent that to Claire Conley at Field and Stream, and he took that too and paid me $1,000 each for two of them. Wow. I said, gee, this is a lot of fun. I love doing these. I think the second one, First Trout, First Lie, is a better story and is closer to what I knew how to, what I finally set upon as a writing voice that I had confidence in. Since then I wrote maybe 200-300 of these little, I call them shaggy fish stories. There seem to be an endless number that come from the fishing world. Sometimes just an odd situation, like some grand fly fisherman who boasted about the number of fish he caught once too often. And I'd heard a story about him coming off a float trip on the Madison River and having caught a 15-inch rainbow. And the guide told me, he said, well, that's the first time I've had a fish grow 6 inches between when we left and when we got back. But a lot of little things happened. Gingrich telling me that he had caught, Arnold Gingrich from Esquire telling me that he had caught on a Western trip 19 inches worth of trout in 4 installments. Or Charles Ritz once, when I published his book, having lunch with him in a rather fancy New York restaurant. He had just fly fished in salt water for the first time, and I said, he was about 83, 84, very vigorous, and had just brought his mistress into the Ritz Hotel, I think. I said, did you enjoy it? I didn't know what to ask. And he said, well, it is like sex after lunch, men for hard with hard stomachs. I think the editing I did, the fun I had with the 100-odd books on fishing, most of them about 90% on fly fishing, I think gave me a huge amount of pleasure. Met some very interesting people, fished some very interesting water for tarpon, trout in France, in England on the chalk streams and whereabouts. I think it was Frank, actually, who not only gave me the first story, but also gave me the suggestion of republishing some of the greater, older books. And I knew about Art Flick's Streamside Guide. I did not know Marinaro from a sauce. I mean, he just was a totally new name to me. And I started with those two. Frank introduced me to Art Flick, with whom I got along very well. I published his little book. I had insisted to the editor-in-chief that we do it with a water-resistant binding, since it was a book that seemed to be proper for taking to the river, and even if you didn't drop it in, it at least would resist any kind of splash. And I remember him saying, well, we'll try it with a lead binding so that it sinks and people will have to buy another one. But the flick was amazing. It sold 15,000 copies before you could blink. And they suddenly said, well, sign up all the ones that you can. That will sell 15,000 right away. And I did some practical books that this was when 40 years ago that I started doing these. Some of them still very much in print. I remember the first practical book was Selective Trout, which did very well and still sells. I did Lefty, poor Lefty is not well now. I did his book with Mark Sosin, Practical Fishing Knots. I was always a little more reluctant to do practical books because I'm not good with my hands. I tie with three thumbs, and the technical aspects of fishing somehow have been less interesting to me, though enormously important and enormously interesting. One of the books that was not about anything technical was old Sparse Gray Hackle's book, which had been called Fishless Days originally when it was published by the Anglers Club. And I met with Sparse, and we had some, he was a remarkable man. I think he was in his early 80s. He had been the debating champion of New York State in 1914. I mean, really a remarkable old fellow. And I once went fishing with him on the DeBruce water, and he said to Mary, you know, Nick has been working too hard. I why don't you go fishing, Nick, and I'll entertain your missus. This great old fellow talked to her about ballistics in the Mexican-American War for about an hour. Mary just smiled and said she didn't remember or understand a word of what he had said. But Sparse's book is one of those odd practical, not practical books that had a very, very interesting life as well. I bet him the summer I was feeling very cocky that these books could really sell. And I bet Sparse a dime that we would sell out the first 7,500, which is a large printing, of this book of stories is what they are. Nothing practical in it at all. There's a very funny story in it, Who is Sparse Gray Hackle, about some 50-pound trout and soaking bread with scotch, and it's a bizarre thing. I didn't see how it could sell 7,510 years, but I bet him anyway, because I'm a dime I could afford to spend. And in late November, we had to go back to press, and I called up Sparse and I told him, "No, we're going back, and I'm winning the bet. I mean, we've sold out that edition. You owe me a dime." And he said, "Oh, rah, rah." Every time he came by, which I don't know what his work was, but he always seemed free enough to show up, and with his double-breasted suit and his very formal and big, thick glasses. He's still the best proofreader I ever met. But he could barely see, I think. I'd say, "Sparse, can you pay me the dime, please?" He said, "It's a very serious bet. I was very serious about this. I worked very hard to sell it." He says, "Don't worry, Buster. I always pay my debts. Around April, this gnome of a man shows up and drops a box on my desk, and he says, "I always pay my damn debts, Buster," and walks out. And I wish I had it here in Woodstock, but he gave me a bound in green Moroccan leather with the dime inserted into the head of it, and with the inscription for Nick, who published this book. I had good days with it. I tried to solve some fights between multiple authors. I had strange things happen. Sparse once told me that he wrote something for Sports Illustrated in which he talked about someone named Reginald Koshwa, I think was the name, who had once deigned to use an olive nymph. Mostly he was a dry fly fisherman. And Sports Illustrated, without checking, pretty good checkers, they had run it. The copy editor said, "What is an olive nymph? I never heard of such a thing," and changed it to live nymph. And for a fly fisherman, fishing with a live nymph is 10 times worse. Sparse said it was the most libelous change of one letter in the history of the English language. And he never wrote for Sports Illustrated again. He was a man of great principle. I had some very pleasant, funny, interesting, great friendships that came from it. I had the pleasure of developing really a list that I was very proud of. I had books that I missed that I won't tell you about today, but that happens also. And then I sold the business the people who took it over did not work well with some of the fly fishers, and they went to other places, and that old list was dispersed. I think there's very little of it left, though there's still Alliance Press that's owned by a company in Maryland. At any rate, I've chatted on very fast, said everything I know about fishing, though that I can remember. There are lots of stories that I have in these various books. Is there any? Have I gone on too long?
No, not at all.
Or too little? I can go on for hours. Now that I see that my memory works enough to go back to my sixth year, I can go on for somewhat longer. I remember Ed Estapchuk writing me a letter that I didn't understand his Aesopus well enough in those days, but I would take I'd race off from my four children in Woodstock and my wife leaving them alone with them, or the two babysitters, and the portal would be on, and I didn't know how to get information on it, so I said I'd had an erratic relationship to it. I once dropped a good English bamboo rod by a man named Dennis Bailey into the Esopus. Coming out of it after dark, I always fished late. I had the rod tucked under my arm. It must have fallen out. So I got to the bank and there was no rod. And it was a little turbid then, a little chalky. I went back the next day and kicked around in that spot. It's just upstream of the Emerson Inn where the railroad is now parked all the time, which I like to fish, and found the rod. It was very generous to me that day. And I loved the Esopus. There is one great story that some of you, most of you probably know, called In Praise of Trout and Also Me, by Paul O'Neill, whose son now writes a lot that's distributed here, which is a wonderful, wonderful story. One of the best of the fishing stories, I think. Anything I can talk about that you'd like, you want to know? Are you all holding fishing stories that you want to publish?
Actually, Sandra, I have a question.
Sure.
Two questions for you. Number one, what's your proudest story / work revolving around fishing?
That's a good question. I had the good fortune to meet a curmudgeonly old guy named Herbert Wellington through a friend of mine who fished a lot in Montana. And we got into a correspondence the better part of a year, I think, from the winter on until the summer, and passed a lot of letters. He was a letter writer, and when I get caught up, I have a granddaughter whom I write to twice a week, so I write a lot. But Herbert and I would talk about fishing matters and who we liked and not. And he invited me to come out and fish his water in the West, and I had no idea what it was. I had fished the chalk streams in England, the Kennet in particular, but also the Test and the Kentish Stour, the Stour River, which is the river that runs down into Canterbury that you see in all of the paintings by somebody who, Constable, all the Constable paintings. Lovely river. But I'd fished the Kennet a lot, and it had whipped me pretty badly. The British streams are reasonably shallow, very, very clear. The trout have been fished over by some great fishermen. And you have to be pretty precise. They have their own set of rules, as most of you know, that you have to see the trout before you cast. You're not allowed to cast until you see a specific trout that you're casting to. And it is a good discipline, actually, though when I started, it just scared the hell out of me. They finally put me at a bridge where there was a fish called Old George or something like that, some 7 or 8 pound brown that had been in there for years. Nobody had caught it because it hung out under the bridge, which was a little downstream of where you cast from. You couldn't cast to it from the lower part. And downstream fishing being frowned on, nobody had really fished for it. They said, let them have a go. Let the American have a go at Old George. And there were about 6 or 7 more than that, maybe 8 or 10 people lined up in a little semicircle to watch the American fish for Old George. I didn't know what to do. My first time on the water, I didn't want to insult them. On the other hand, I was very anxious not to be made a damn fool of. I get in the water, and the caddis all over the place. They're just bouncing up and down. So I take a troth caddis, which is a terrific fly, and I lay it out as across stream as I can go with a little wave, and the bloke's fishing downstream, someone shouts. Finally, I do the best I can to keep it reasonably across stream and not up, and sure enough, Old George comes up, takes the fly, I strike it, and oh, He's got, and I snap him right off in front of everyone. But that, I'd done a little of that, and then Herb Wellington invited me out. And it turns out that not only does he fish in the West and have a nice ranch, but he has 8 to 10 miles curving, probably the equivalent of 12 miles, of a remarkable spring creek called Odell Spring Creek, which flows for about 12 or 14 miles and then goes into the Madison near Ennis. And there are only two landowners. He owns one section, someone else owns another. And his section is right in the middle and it's all the best water. I think the times I fished out there were the most interesting, challenging, satisfying of all the fishing I've ever had. I love the Catskills and I love the rivers, that the many that I fished from the Schoharie, the Beaverkill, the Willowemoc, and certainly the Esopus too. But this thing was remarkable. It was one of those unfished, unstocked rivers with just the right balance between the amount of food available and then the trout. They, in most places, hung out under undercut banks that were deeper than the table. I mean, sometimes you'd get close to the edge and step in and you could see that it was really hollow. I fished it for the first time for about 3 weeks, and it took me a week before I caught a trout. I was reasonably good by then, but the trout had their own patterns. He only allowed the dry fly. I couldn't quite get it. I just didn't really understand it. I caught some trout that first trip, and then the third or fourth trips we made, I started to get a lot. And it was fascinating because it had a rhythm and it had a logic to it. The pale morning duns would start at about 10 o'clock, and they'd go on with little changes right up until dark, when the caddis would start, just until dark. Every now and then there'd be, in the July 4th weekend, there would be the western green drake that came off, and it was astonishing. It was like a circus. The fish you could see them in the shallow water making a wake right across 20 feet of I don't know how they tell, but they would go 20 feet across after a real green drake fluttering on the other side of the creek. It was astonishing fishing. It was not quite like that wonderful G.E.M. Skews story called Mr. Theodore Castwell, in which someone finds himself in hell and he catches trout after trout. And he says, "Can't we stop?" And then his keeper says, "No." "You mean I've got to go on catching these 2-pounders?" "Yes," says the keeper. It wasn't like that because the fish were all varied. They remained hard right up until the last time I fished it. And you had to be pretty canny to do much business with them. I fished it a lot, and I really fell in love with it. Caught some very big trout. I saw Wellington catch one that I think was 30 inches. It was a dog of a fish. I mean, it was just absolutely gigantic, like a salmon. I was sitting next to him when he was casting from a sitting position, and I saw the fish take. He fought it all the way to the end, and then it finally was right next to him, and the hook pulled out. And he didn't throw his rod down or get angry. He'd seen them before, but it had that kind of fish in it, hidden. I never got anything more than about 21, 22 inches. But I found it a remarkable fishery, endlessly interesting. Wellington was very close to, he never talked about his friends, and you didn't know who his friends were. And he was very much contained in what he said. But he was a very close friend of Harry Darby's, and he would bring Harry out for a a couple of weeks, and Harry would camp down on this, down near the creek. Herb had about 500 Derby flies in a jar, and they had a break-in. The guys, they stole the jar and threw all the flies out the window. But it was a great place. I went back in the summer of 2015, 2 years ago, and they had done the other landowner, and this is something, you know, that what you were writing about, Tony, had done extensive renovation of the stream, and the reports were that the renovation was great, the fishery was very healthy, it was producing some big fish. The problem was that Wellington's water in the middle had gotten all the silt. The silt had come down, and there was a famous pool that is on the jacket, actually, of one of the books that I donated. The pool was about 12 feet deep. You know, as it came around, it was a bend pool, and after the turn, it was about 12 feet deep, and the fish, you could see them in the very clear water, maybe 25, 30 trout, and they would rise almost as if they had meal tickets of some kind. I mean, there'd never be more than one or two rising, but there would be if you rested it, there would always be something coming back in a few minutes. I loved the pool and fished it a number of times. That summer, 2 years ago, there was an island where that indentation had been, with plants growing out of it and everything else. It was terrible. I mean, the silt had literally killed the fly life. I saw no pale morning duns. The water temperature was close to 70, which for a spring creek, and that particular spring creek, is at least 10 or 12 degrees higher than it ever was. I did not catch a fish. I fished in places that I knew well. I think screwing around with a river, you get that now and then. That's happening. Tony Bonavist is writing something on the Beaverkill about that, and Van Putt has been involved with it. And it's really it gums up rivers if you don't think about the whole thing. But that, in a few words to answer what my favorite fishing experience, it was fishing that creek and the times when it was the best and the times when it really was very tragic. I had two or three wonderful, wonderfully interesting episodes. Lefty came out once as a friend of Wellington's, and I fished with him. And he fished one. He has several times said, Nick has just been lying all these years. He's a better fisherman than he makes out, because there was a situation, one, where Lefty was fishing some little run. And I said, Lefty, you know, after he was done, you know, they really won't come up if you stand up like that. He knows enough to bend in certain sections. And he said, well, creep up. So I crept up. And then fish came up, and I caught it pretty quickly. And I said, oh my gosh, you've been lying all these years. Lefty was very interesting. I think the only real mistake I've ever seen Lefty make or hear about, he made on that pool I just mentioned. You know, as the water came around the pool, around the corner, around the turn, went under an undercut bank on the far side, then it opened up maybe into this big pool, and then it had another couple of runs along the far bank. And we were coming up the stream, and he sees a rise right up at the curve of the bend, right where there's an overhanging branch. And he says, I'm going to try for that. I said, Lefty, don't. You know, he said, I can reach it. Don't worry, I can reach it. It was about 120 feet away. And I said, Lefty, that's not the point. He throws it. Maybe it was 3 inches off where it should be, but it didn't catch. And then he threw two more up there, and the fish was down already. And it was gorgeous cast. It was just a beautiful cast. And then I said, Lefty, you've never been on this pool. Let me show you something. And we walked to a place where you could look down into the heart of the pool. And he had put down about 35 trout with this extraordinary cast of his. I think those things happen. And I think Lefty was one of the great fishermen, or is one of the great fishermen. He had a lot of, Wellington had a lot of people come who to visit. He had Sid Neff there once. Do you know Sid? Does anyone know Sid? You know, he's, Sid's a very intense fly fisherman. He does beautiful book bindings, just gorgeous. And gets angry very quickly. I fished with him one day and he ran ahead of me to get to this big pool, which sort of put me out of any sympathy with him. But I had found some fishing, and I asked him when he was coming off the water, did you have some fun, Sid? And he said, very serious voice, dead serious. He said, I never have fun when I fish. It's the end of the conversation. You know, I always have fun. I mean, I'm just on the other side of the equation. If anyone else dares to ask a question now, I have another hour that I can talk on. Anything else about the publishing world or this or that? I had a lot of fun publishing 100 odd books. And Mike Valla. Is Mike Valla here by any chance? No?
No.
Mike Valla wrote me a wonderful letter telling me that he had had a difficult teenage time of his life, and that the books I was publishing at Crown had really, the Marinaro, the Jennings, the Flick, and the Lizen Ring, he said they had saved his life. And then, what else do I want to hear from a publishing career than I've had some effect or given somebody some pleasure?
I was going to say, if no one else is going to ask a question, I have one more question. Sorry.
It's terrific.
As a writer, I just thought it was a good idea to ask, do you find that there's a story in every experience when you go out fishing?
I do. I think there are, and I think that it's the strangest thing. I don't know that any other sport quite has that. I know there are people who say there are stories in a golf game of golf, and so I heard a terrible story about Mr. Trump playing with someone, and the guy said, well, I can't play with you anymore. And he asked why. He said, well, you cheat. And apparently Trump answered, I do cheat. I cheat, and I cheat on my wife, and I cheat in business. He said, and if you can't handle it, maybe we shouldn't play together. I don't know whether that's apocryphal or not. But it's an amusing story. No, but I think, you know, there are good baseball writers, good baseball situations. I know someone who writes only on the horses and writes. But somehow the literature of fly fishing, or the act of fly fishing, or the connection to the water, the number of variables, the number of moving parts, the number of different characters. I don't think I've ever gone on the water where I haven't come back with a story of some kind.
Did you ever do anything with Red Smith?
I knew him a bit, but I like his writing enormously.
But early season, before the season started.
I asked him to do a little book on fishing, and he said he writes, the most he gets is 1,100 words. He says that's the limit, and he writes within that. He has the most natural sense of metaphor of any sports writer I know. Think of one marvelous. He's describing a shortstop, and he says he covered the ground like crabgrass. It's terrific. I mean, it's just as fast and full of life as anything. He's a great writer, and I like his fishing stories too, of which there is a little collection called Red Smith on Fishing.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to get that.
Good.
Collection. Anyway.
I wanted to say one thing. I came, one of the reasons I'm here today, Nick, is to thank you. My name's Chris Hensley.
Oh, yes.
About 3 years ago, I was partly inspired by your writings and publishings to do an event down the road called Trout Tales, where we brought together many of the guys in this
terrific
room.
Terrific thing. It's Spillion.
Came, yep, it's Spillion. And it started, you know, the idea was just to sort of tell some fish stories and connect to the past. It was successful, and now this year, in our fourth year, it's expanded. It's going to be all up and down 28 with multiple businesses involved over a two-month period.
That's
so
great.
It's sort of taken on a life of its own, and I wanted to thank you because early on you were encouraging. You couldn't attend that year, but you provided us some books and autographs. You did some interviews for us on the radio, and it was so much appreciated, and
I wanted to thank you for that. I had an odd time after I stopped teaching. I never used notes when I taught for 30 years in the classroom. But when I got out, I got very shy, and I used to write everything out. And it sounded so prepackaged and some joke I'd worked on, something like that, just came out so flat and predictable that I really decided not to talk in public at all anymore. And then went up, as Mark knows, I talked up at the Hilltop Historical Society in June, and it just encouraged me to think that maybe I could remember some of these things and talk and have a conversation with folks instead of writing something out.
Well, and so I'm changed. And I love the anecdote that you tell about to be a successful fisherman, you have to put a little piece of your heart on the hook, too.
Did I say that?
So
it's a nice phrase.
Yeah.
My goodness. What genius I had then. Oh, dear.
I just have a question because when you went to the University of Pennsylvania, what was your major when you went there?
Alas, it was insurance.
That was the whole thought. And when you went to grad school?
It's another part of my life that I'm writing about now.
Oh, but, good. It just seems that's always
I literally hated the Wharton School. I cannot think of, I don't know why I stayed. I was on the basketball team. It doesn't look like it now, but that was 100 pounds ago. And we had a great star then named Ernie Beck and won the Ivy League. And I once wrote a profile of him. When I learned how to write, and wrote to him and said, Ernie, I was on the other end of the bench. You probably don't remember me. He said, I remember you very well, Nick. He said, you were a skinny little kid from Brooklyn who could run all day. Now I can't walk without a cane. Things change. No, I was at Penn, and I think I stayed because I was very much connected to basketball and to crew, which I liked a lot. And then when I went into the Army, I remember the day it happened, but I read Big Two-Hearted River, the Hemingway story, and I just said, my gosh, do people write about fishing? And is there some kind of writing I can do? I didn't do anything for another 5 or 6 years. But in the Army, I began to read everything I could find, and it was really very scattered reading. I literally would read everything from Mickey Spillane to Kafka. I mean, just whatever I could get my hands on. And when I got out, I decided to go back to school. Then I decided, you know, I'm nowhere. I don't know where my head is. I don't know what, I'm not going to go into insurance. I just dislike it. And I like it now. It helped. If Medicare isn't knocked out, I'm going to be very happy. But I went back as a freshman to Bard College, which is just across the river. Actually, I went to at the New School for 6 months in New York City, and the guy there at the end of the term, I said, you know, a man named Keith Botsford, a very esoteric course called English Prose Style, which we read everything from the early English to Henry James very intensely. And I realized something that term something about my interest in language, the enormous. And I remember at the end of the term walking up to him and saying, sort of, can I make the team? can I go on? Is it stupid of me to think that I can understand this stuff? And he cocky son of a bitch, and he said to me, he said, Nick, he says, you're not dumb. You're just absolutely illiterate. I took that as a great compliment at the time. And I went to Bard as a freshman under the GI Bill. And Ruth was there then, and my wife was there. I got married that summer and trailed married to Cranbrook in Michigan and looked around for some place to go back to school there to parlay the courses at the New School and Bard College, none of which had been anywhere near better than a B minus. I'd been a terrible student. And some awful monster that like Grendel in Beowulf guarded the door to the MA program and said I should go back to the garment district, that I would never get through here. But I said, it's too late. I'm already signed up. I'm ready to go. Can you let me into the MA program? And he said, I can't. Actually, I can't. But go and take these psychological and aptitude tests and then come back and we'll talk. And I came back and he said, well, I really can't keep you out, but I'm not going to let you into the program unless you get 5 A's, which I'd never gotten in my life. And we were living up in Pontiac, which is about 50 miles from Ann Arbor. And in the winter, I'd come down. It was like a bobsled trail going down on the Pontiac Trail. And I got 5 A's and really began to discipline myself then. He let me in, and I got a doctorate. I got an MA and then a doctorate a couple of years later. And I'm reasonably comfortable with my head now. But it's the kind of change that I think we all make or should make sometime in our lives when we say, this is the thing I want to do, and I'm late learning it, but I'm going to go back to the beginning if I have to. And learn it. And I see a lot of people who make choices later on, some much later than I did. I thought I was antique at 25, but it turned out to be a very fortuitous choice, scared me out of my wits. I was in total apprehension that I could get through, and it was just a delight year after year to see that my head was good enough to get through all of this, and that it was that I just lost a lot of time, but that time really didn't matter. It certainly doesn't matter now. At 85, you don't worry too much about time anymore.
Sporting legends of the Catskills. Nick Lyons, Reflections and Remembrances, A Life Well Fished, Saturday, December 2nd, 2017. News and events at CatskillAnglingCollection.org. Made possible with funds from the Catskill Watershed Corporation in partnership with New York City DEP. Thanks also to our sponsor, the 52-mile Catskill Mountains Scenic Byway, following New York State Route 28 through the heart of the Central Catskills. For maps, itineraries, and links to area restaurants, shops, and accommodations, visit scenickatskills.com. CatsCast is a production of Silver Hollow Audio. Please don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks. I'm Brett Barry. Thanks for listening.